most siblings, it's Mo here. Before we dive into this month's episodes, I just want to set the tone a little. These episodes sit close to my heart. We've been talking about culture for a while now. Not the textbook version, but the real thing, you know. The stuff that shapes how we move around the world, how we speak to ourselves, how we love, and how we survive. And this month's stories feel like a continuation of that. You hear from people whose lives stretch across continents and languages, people who have built careers caring for children, navigating global systems, or helping others untangle the wounds they grew up pretending didn't hurt. You hear reflections on what it means to grow up in cultures that don't always give room for softness and what it looks like to reclaim that softness as adults. You hear about identity, belonging, and the quiet courage it takes to heal old wounds, especially the ones passed down to us. And somewhere in the middle of all of that, you'll get a small window into my own life and career, the friendships that have helped me for almost a decade, the cross-cultural lessons I'm still learning, and the everyday ways I'm still becoming. So take a breath with me, settle in. This month is tender, layered, and very human. Now, let's get into the episode.
Siblings, gather around. I need to confess something. So in the first 10 minutes of this conversation, the UK internet did what the UK internet sometimes does. It revolted. It staged a tiny Brexit from the recording. It unplugged itself from the commonwealth of common sense. It chose vibes over duty. You get the point. And just like that, poof, the opening segment vanished into the digital abyss. Now listen, I have recorded over 350 episodes across my pod life, across continents, time zones, airports, hospitals, cafe, noisy Korean cafes, you get the point. Only twice has something like this happened. The first time was the one time I forgot to hit record. Podcaster, rookie mistake. Like Bruno, we don't talk about it. And now this, the tale of the great UK Wi-Fi disappearance of 2025. And that's because my guest was based in the UK. So in the beginning of the episode, when we did the warm-up, there were some fluctuations on his end, and we had to turn off camera to preserve bandwidth. And despite all of that, I lost 10 minutes of a segment. Now, normally I would obsess, you know, re-record, re-script, re-stress. But life is teaching me a new lesson. Sometimes the moment is imperfect, but the message is still powerful. Release it anyway. So here we are, right? You're getting this episode as is, raw, unpolished, where it needs to be, and rich where it truly matters. And because the intro went MIA, let me do the honors of introducing our guest properly. Now, our guest today, Mr. Ojogbani Okolo, brings over a decade of experience in the UK financial service industry, with roles spanning compliance, AML, and customer experience. He's also ventured into digital assets and the Web3 ecosystem, co-launching a derivative NFT project titled Ape of Lagos. But beyond titles and industries, Mr. Ojogbani is a thinker, the rare kind who can sit with nuance, hold tension, ask uncomfortable questions, and still make you laugh in the process. And special shout out to my wonderful friend, Krabby Sebastian, aka Yinka Jalalsho, for these introductions. Now, today on this episode, Gani, like I call him, joins me to explore the big things shaping modern life, like acculturation, anti-intellectualism, fear of failure versus fear of success, migration, faith, and the noisy tug of war between knowledge and the algorithms that flatten it. This is a conversation about ideas, identity, and the courage to think for yourself. That's the introduction. Now, before I let you go and get on to the episode, let me just say that losing the first part of this episode reminded me of something I'm still learning. You can prepare, you can plan, you can perfect, but life will still glitch at the most inconvenient times. Sometimes your Wi-Fi will drop. Sometimes recording will fail. Sometimes the things you wanted to preserve disappears. But guess what? The conversation continues. The story continues, right? And you don't need a perfect beginning for the middle to be meaningful or the ending to be beautiful. Someone should tweet that and tag me. And maybe that's a lesson I needed today, right? Show up anyway. Share it anyway. Let it be what it is. And as someone who's had very difficult times navigating gray areas. It was either black and white. Let me just say, this is a great moment for me, and I want to just stop and acknowledge how far I've come in my life. So here's to imperfect recordings, shifting connections, and conversations that still manage to land with clarity and heart. And that, my siblings, is the real work of adulthood and migration and creativity and becoming, to keep going even when the opening chapters don't make it into the final cut. So on behalf of me and everyone on the Mosible team, let's say enjoy this beautiful, wide-ranging, gapless beginning part of the episode with Mr. Ojogbanokolo, minus the first 5 minutes, you know, plus a whole lot of heart, humor, and depth. All right, then, enjoy the show. Thank you. All of a sudden my recording just stopped. AI at its best. So anyways, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. So that was kind of weird. Yeah. Anyways, I would have to say that the constitution should also go both ways. But as you are a visitor to the other person's land, think of the negotiables. Like, what are the rules of the land? You don't want to enter, you know, issues with legal issues and all those kind of murky waters. So make sure you do the right things. And the other things, you know, as best as you can, if you want to at least buy that social networking that can help improve your life. Because in this part of the world, it's who you know for most places, and the kind of company you keep, it will determine the level of information you get and the access you have to different things. So it will bid you well to aggressively network and meet the right kind of people and make the right kind of connections. All right. Are you still there? Yeah, okay.
Can I just add something as well?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. Of course. Yeah.
So I just want to add just a tip. Since we're talking about tips, one very practical tip is, if you can afford it, go for a local sporting game. Do something fun. Go for it. And that's one of the ways I quickly integrated. Yeah. One of the first things I did when I came to the UK was I went, and so this was the day, this was when I was in Coventry, right? I went for an ice hockey game. And that's not really like a game where you see a lot of black people, to be honest. Like, I remember that day, it was a 4,000 person arena. And I remember being like maybe one or two of a handful of black people there. But it got me to the culture, and I found out that I actually loved the game. But yeah, so get outside of your comfort zone. Go for like a game. And if you can't afford to go for a game, if you can't afford to pay to watch a game or watch a sporting event, go to like the free ones, like the parks where a game is going on, or, you know. But I find that having fun is one of the best ways to quickly socially integrate. It's easier. Do you get what I mean?
So yeah.
Just wanted to add that.
You might as well have some fun while you're doing it. And football, when I think about men as a whole, you guys are so loyal when it comes to like sports. You love it so much, you dedicate it to the game. But I think that life will be a lot easier. And this is just me. Maybe it's my female privilege going. If you can follow that with continuity, do you know how many times I've had to plan play dates for my husband? Like, I would meet someone, he would introduce me to his colleague, you know, from work, say a female. And myself and the female become fast friends. Yeah. And they will start lamenting, oh, we wish our husbands, you know, were more social. We'll plan to have double dates, like, oh, you know, bring your husband along, and they will hit it off, they will talk, but they don't follow up. Meanwhile, myself and your work colleague, we become besties, you know. We're talking about when are we gonna go shopping next, when are we gonna go try this new restaurant, but the husbands are just there, and I'm like, you guys need to do more than just sitting down and watching TV or playing pickleball. Like, call your friend. Did you check in on that person? Have fun. I like that. You know,
go to a sporting
event.
I know.
Yeah. I want to really spend a little bit of time with the anti-intellectualism part of the conversation, because that's what really inspired me bringing you on this podcast. But before then, let's do a little bit of a stop. And I want to really tease out fear of failing or even of succeeding. Which one feels scarier to you personally? Is it failing publicly or succeeding loudly? And I think those two have equal moments of fear that can really trigger a lot of emotions in one. It's one thing to fail, it's another thing to actually succeed. And those carry, you know, different forms of maybe anxiety or guilt or just heaviness. You know, they might not be the same, but there's still some emotions attached to it. But I'm just curious to know, for you, what feels scarier to you personally? Failing publicly or succeeding loudly, and why?
You know, if I'm being honest, totally honest with you, mm-hmm. I don't know. I think they're both equally are. I don't know how to put a measure on it. Because I instinctively don't like to be in the limelight.
Mm-hmm.
I struggle with it. A lot of my friends have told me to even start my own podcast or at least create more content, put my voice out there because of the conversations that we have.
Mm.
But I haven't. It's something that I'd think about. I think that I would say that the fear of publicly failing is more, especially as it means that it would have been preceded by success. That makes sense. Because you're not failing from being a failure, are you?
Yeah.
To be fair, you could fail from an attempt. So I think that the fear of publicly failing, especially after I've had some success, is more for me.
Mm.
I think I can deal with the fear of success I can deal with that better because A, I can easily just not be accessible to people, because again, the public part of it is what I struggle with, right? Because that was the question, being publicly successful.
Yeah, feeling
so it's the public part of it that I struggle. Yeah, the public part of it is what I struggle with. You know, being out there and being the face of something is, and being known for something is, I don't know why. But I can deal with that because if it's success, it means that I'll have the resources to ensure that I don't have to always be public about it. Does that make sense? But if you fail publicly, I feel that it's just, I don't know.
For me,
I think it'll be failing publicly. So that's, I don't know if that answer makes any sense, but I think I'm more scared of failing publicly because I think not because I wouldn't have that. You know, the funny thing is that I have people around me who will literally be like, look, this is not the end. Get up and go. I have an army of people around me who want the best for me.
Yeah.
But I think it's my own inner voice, my self, the voice in my head that tells me, oh, that's it. You've done it now.
Yeah.
You've gone and messed up, you know. Mm. So, yeah.
I think, you know what? I think succeeding loudly might be harder, you know. Yeah, failing publicly is embarrassing. Yes, there's no doubt about that. But people move on. But I think that success, on the other hand, comes with the pressure to keep performing, to prove that you deserve the spotlight. And there's always that never-ending diminishing returns of you have to keep. So when you, it's like when you hear like a banger, like a song, like you become that one hit wonder, or you have the performance of your life, and the next thing you do, people are, it's not as good as that. That your music never do so. But I think that you know, it's, there's your, it's just how you want to bounce back, and I think that's where resilience comes into place, because they both have their pressure, you know, succeeding loudly or feeling publicly, whatever it is, don't stay down for too long, right? And just keep moving, because people have gone through what you've gone through. What makes the story different is how you bounce back. So develop resilience. Yeah. Now, are you of faith, by the way?
Thank you for that.
You're welcome. Are you of faith, by the way?
I'm Christian. I'm a Christian.
Okay. Yeah, the next question was just gonna be about faith.
I'm a Christian.
Okay. There was something I read today on someone's post. There's always been the issue of, you know, atheism and belief. We're not gonna dive into that because I don't think it will make for a robust conversation yet. But I'm just for you, the post was around, you know, I don't bother with people who used to be Christians and have left their faith. Yada yada, but because that sounds very dismissive. But the way they ended, it was like, not having faith is not a sign of intelligence, and having a faith is not a sign of the lack of intelligence, right? Now, for you, because I know people just think, when I moved to the US, one of the things I really struggled with that made me, it was part of the things that added to me losing my faith, but I eventually got it back, by the way, was just that thing of, if you're a true scientist, you shouldn't believe in Jesus or believe, have a faith, because it's almost like believing in Santa Claus. But the more I left faith and I started just exploring on my own, I realized that, wow, like, you cannot believe in science without believing there should be like a master being, and everything could have happened with Big Bang. Big Bang is very, at its best, is entropic, you know. How would this master design? It can't just be coincidental. I say all of that to say, do you think faith silences intellectual doubt, or do you think it gives you permission to ask bigger questions for you?
I think faith. I think so. When it comes to faith and, you know, logic, one of the things that or science, I don't think they are inseparable. So to answer your question, I think that faith is, for me personally, faith is, it kind of like a, How do I best say this? I don't think so. First of all, I don't think that faith and science, you know, are in conflict.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the next really are in conflict. I think that the conflict is a little bit manufactured. That's one. And then I also feel that the argument usually that atheists use against faith is that, you know, faith isn't logical, and as such, you can't be a scientist and also have faith. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
And my problem with that is that there are completely, They are wrong in the sense that we all have faith in a way. We even there being atheists, there's something they have faith in.
Mm.
And all of life isn't logic. As a matter of fact, anyone who only thinks about life through a logical lens, usually that person is on, you know, usually not a good person. they usually can explain everything away.
They're exactly. They're not people centered for the most part. They're usually
psychopaths because for them everything follows a logical that's the way I see it. So I think that it's one of those questions for me where I can't, for me, I just feel that belief and science can go hand to hand. Belief and logic can go hand in hand. Belief kind of like is an extension of where logic ends. Especially as science also has gaps, right? Now, I know somebody who's listening to this might counter with what in the science world is called the God of the Gaps. The concept of the God of the Gaps is that we use God as an explanation for any physical phenomenon or phenomena that we can't explain until science now explains it, and then we're like, oh, okay. Ah, okay, there's a scientific explanation for it now. And so we use God. I know somebody might counter with that, but for me, that's not in essence what I'm saying. I leave room for discovery, I leave room for science and all of that. But for me, faith is about an understanding of what I can't quantify and what I can't quantify would be the word. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that question completely. And I think this answer in itself just shows where I am when it comes to faith, because one thing I try not to do is to try and force anything into a straitjacket. I think faith is wonderful, and it gives expression to the hope that we have. And I think science is the discovery of God's creation, is a discovery of the natural. So people say science is a discovery or an interpretation of natural law, right? Or discovery of natural law and all of that. I just replace nature with God. And really and truly, we don't really have atheists. So this is my belief. We don't have atheists. What we have are people who are agnostics, because the real sense of the word atheism, because they can't really know that there's no God, right? And you know, they can't empirically prove that there's no God, and we can't also empirically prove that there is God. We perceive God through faith. We access God through faith. And so I think that's my approach to it. My approach to it, and that's why sometimes I don't really bother with, you know, I don't know if you know the part of many faiths called apologetics.
I love that.
I used to love it, but I no longer. I think it's good. I mean, I'm sure it works. There are some people that it helps, right? But for me personally, my framework, my mental model, or my mental framework for faith is that this is like a portal that helps me understand the things that we cannot understand. That helps me frame the things that we cannot access God, essentially. Whereas science helps us to work out empirically the laws of that God himself has made in nature. So yeah, that, I don't know if I answered the question, but I just feel I've been waffling. but that's my approach to it.
Thanks for sharing that with that. And there's so many things I picked from what you talked about, especially with the God of gaps and how science in itself isn't always all encompassing, and we still need some almost like something to not almost like fill in the cracks, but something to kind of like contextualize, especially the foundational underpinnings of what we believe in, right? And yeah, in your apologetics, there was time in my life where it was just what I really held on to because I wanted to strengthen my faith. And right these days, I don't, I mean, like C.S. Lewis is one of my favorite thinkers, right? And I,
yeah,
those time his books, you know, I held on to them like I was holding on to a life jacket. And I will still reference his books and, you know, recommend his books and even his writings to people who I know where currently where I used to be. But I don't find them as useful right now because of the journey I'm on, right? So that doesn't mean that I don't believe in apologetics. So I just wanted to, like, for me, I still, there's a time and place where I needed, you know, apologetics and I needed that. But I still definitely see them as important resources for understanding why you have faith and why faith is still useful in a time like this. Yeah. But I appreciate how you put it. You know, faith at its best isn't a checklist, you know, it's a framework. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I think you're absolutely, I think we're basically saying the same thing.
Different. Actually. Yes. Yes.
I think you put it better than I could have put it. I think that apologetics usually, there are places for, there is a crowd of people that are trying to read, because first of all, there is this caricature that people who are not of faith make about people of faith.
Mm.
You know, there's this stereotype of, you know, there's no logic, no reasoning whatsoever. But apologetics are able to have a very, you know, a good faith conversation with these people and say, look, this is why this, you know, this is why we believe what we believe.
Yeah.
And they're able to put it in such a way that it you know, it's a lot more palatable to people who only believe that we should focus on logic and reasoning. And people who think that, you know, religion is diametrically opposed to enlightenment. So these apologetics are able to shine a light on how religion isn't, you know, or faith isn't actually all that.
Yeah.
That,
yeah.
You know, and they're able to shine the light aspect of it, enlighten as well. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I brought up this example because I could sense that was what you were trying to explain. You know, you weren't dismissing apologetics. It was just, you know, trying to explain that. Yeah. All right. So I think it would be a good way to segue into our next topic. I love, you know, what you've explained with faith. And it's also interesting that while some people embrace the mystery, others become suspicious of anything that feels like expert knowledge, especially when the evidence is clear. And that brings us something we're seeing a lot these days, anti-intellectualism. Now, as a quick definition for anyone wondering what the heck does this mean, it's the distrust or outright rejection of experts, education, and even scientific knowledge. The idea that thinking too much is a flaw and that expertise equals arrogance. And it's not new. In history, authorities criticize scholars for questioning norms. In the US, it has its roots in political populism, like the common man versus the educated elite. In part of Africa, colonial trauma made Western knowledge feel tied to oppression. Religion and politics have often been framed intellectual curiosity as dangerous. But today, something has shifted. We saw it a lot during the pandemic, you know, COVID, Masks became politics, vaccines became moral statements, and you're just wondering that this 5 years you spent in school and some extra 6 years in PhD, like, what was the point of it if somebody can just Google and get their, you know, their facts right? I guess my first question for you would be this, Ghana, would be on this topic of anti-intellectualism, would be, why do you think expertise itself is now viewed as elitist or threatening? Was it, do you think it's politics, the betrayal from the institutions we've long, you know, regarded, or class divides? What do you think is going on? What the heck do you think is going on?
This is actually one of my favorite topics to talk about. As with any complex social, you know, social ill or social, let me borrow the word from Malcolm Gladwell, social pandemic. There isn't one particular reason why it's happening. I think there is a number of reasons, and I think you've mentioned them already. So I think that the number one is the fact that there's been actually failures, the documented failures that has resulted in loss of lives, or the maiming or the hurting of lives in the past, right? And then there is also, so this, there's been a loss of trust all of this time. You know, I mean, for example, I'll give you an example quickly. I'm sure you are well aware of this because it's you know, up your alley, and you're also from the States. Is it the Tuskegee experiment?
Tuskegee with the syphilis. Alabama. Yes. Yeah.
Mm. Now, that is a documented historical fact. So when Black people, for example, see any government mass health program, Black Americans, if they're now suspicious of it, you kind of like can understand why they are suspicious of it.
There's a reason behind it. Yeah, I would see that a lot. This is my area of research. I study Black men, prostate cancer, and
thank you.
Yeah, it's a big issue.
Thank you. So there is a historical hurt to it, and then you've also mentioned the whole Africans having the colonial
trauma,
distrust for
trauma.
Based on trauma, and it's all very well. It's all from a genuine, they're all genuine and valid concerns that people have. And then, so all of this has been going on. They've been kind of like, you've had these subcultures over the decades, right? Of people who just distrust Western medicine, people who distrust the government because they're failed. People who distrust science because they feel that there is science that become big science, and that's also valid as well. You know, you have, you know, there's science, if we're going to be honest, did become a little bit political at some point. And it should be, to be fair, science can't really stay away from the politics of things, right?
No, because science is political.
Science is political.
Whether
I like it or not. You know, let's just quickly go back a few hundred years ago. There were leading scientists that believed that, you know, slaves in America were less human than white people, and they gave it a scientific. Because obviously, like with everything, anything you look for, you'll find, right? So anyway, quickly come back to where we are. I don't want to get sidetracked too much. So when you combine all of these factors, you know, mistrust, genuine failings of authorities, and then you combine with the fact that we now had the internet. The internet now came in and now gave everyone a voice. So first of all, the first epoch of the internet was fine.
Yeah, was the elitist, yeah, email, access, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Everything. it was all good and fine.
Yeah.
Then social media. Social media essentially gave everyone a megaphone to speak to the whole world. Just at the press of a button. What that now did was that all of these subcultures of distrust in the government now went mainstream. Now all of a sudden, so really and truly, it's not like anti-intellectualism has grown in a sense, rather than the fact that it has become louder. Well, which has now led to its growth. So yeah, it has grown. It has both become louder and as a result has grown, to be fair. So conspiracy theorists that used to only have like small communities in their basement.
Yeah.
You know.
And they were sent through newspapers and postal mails now at the speed of light.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. They now have blogs and vlogs, and everyone can access that information. So exponentially increasing the number of people that have access to this information. Then you now have, that's one, and then you now have for places like America, and a lot of the West, an increasing desensitization to real vigorous education, an increasing elevation of just mindless entertainment. I always say that this particular epoch we're going through of anti-intellectualism really started from the era of, I don't know if you used to watch MTV.
Yes, yes. Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Oh my goodness. MTV. Yes, yeah. Yes,
I think that programs like that laid the foundation, and then you move from there to what was the one that Paris Hilton and
Nicole. The Simple Life or so.
Simple Life. Thank you.
Yeah.
And it went on to that. Then it was, I can remember very well, I had a visceral reaction to it. Like, why are they making it cool? I can never forget when I felt the first edition of My Simple Life. I was like, why are they making it cool to be ignorant and not knowledgeable about the world around you? Right?
We forgot to mention Jerry Springer show.
Jerry Springer, that's another one. Jerry Springer, and all of those shows, all of the children that grew up on that diet have basically become adults now.
Mm.
And even some of the teenagers that fed through that are now millennials. And some of the early 20s that grew up with that diet of television and entertainment are now, you know, Generation X's. So, and these are the core people. These are the core adults. That's the core cohort of adults that are running the world today. So it makes sense for me that we're where we are today, because when you combine all of these factors together, you know, access to more information, distrust, the erosion of education, critical thinking.
Yep.
I'll add one more thing. The fact that naturally as human beings, let's be honest, the concept of many scientific concepts aren't naturally digestible
for the public person. Yes. And we should take responsibility for that.
Yes, scientists have a part to blame.
Exclusivity. Yeah. And then we came in COVID, almost like wanting to become relatable, and then like forget about
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
We're going to listen to the guy in the tin hats, in the four hats.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Exactly. So, for example, you know, the concept of statistics and epidemiology the concepts within those two fields of study are not naturally things that people can quickly get. It will take a leap of logic for people to quickly understand what's going on. So when somebody says more people have died from the vaccines than haven't, and they can't quite hack the fact that, like, let me use the best example I'll use is, I'm sure you've seen it, that World War II example of survival bias, where they were trying to improve the fighter jets, the American the American Air Force was trying to improve their fighter jets. So the fighter jets that were coming back, they were looking at the parts of the fighter jets that had the bullet, that had all the bullet holes. And they were like, okay, what we're going to do is to improve, is to strengthen the material that we use for those parts of the plane so that it, you know, it doesn't get as damaged. But then someone pointed out to them that actually you're basing your information on the planes that made it back, not the ones that got shut down. And even now, as I'm saying it, I'm struggling to actually even relay these concepts. So you can imagine how the typical person, I get it, but relaying it sometimes could be difficult. So I'll be honest, you know, I'm probably not communicating it in the best way I could, and I'm sure you will do a much better job at it because that's your field, right? So what I'm saying in essence is that the pandemic of 2020, 2021 was a perfect storm of all of these factors converging
to create a perfect storm. To just
create what we have right now. Yeah. People were at home with nothing to do, had access to the internet. Internet was littered with all sorts of misinformation. People already had their suspicions before now. People had gone through like 2-3 decades of mindless education, less critical thinking. All of this come together to give you what we currently have. That's my answer to it.
And we haven't thanks for sharing that, and we haven't quite recovered from that, right? And I think by the time sociologists in the next 20 years will come back to this moment, I'm like, what did we get wrong? As we're listening, you know, Paris and Nicole acting clueless on the simple, I'm like, how could you have forgotten about Keeping Up with the Kardashians, Love and Hip Hop, The Real Housewives, insert this geographical zip code, and then to YouTube and TikTok, where popularity equals to credibility, you know, and then the short attention span. Average article would take you like 20-30 minutes solidly to like read and digest the information. I mean, people have that time to like flip through pages of when you can just get like a 5-minute bite on somebody's "Get Ready With Me" or "Here's my recap of" but yeah, you're right, because on one hand, experts, you know, they've gathered knowledge so tightly that people feel shut out, and on the other hand, when a crisis like COVID hits, suddenly scientists, you know, we had to become relatable overnight, and that whiplash created even more distrust. So I guess my next question for you will be this: if experts do have some responsibility here, which I really think we do, what would it look like for them to rebuild trust without watching down the truth, and how do we make this knowledgeable accessible without making it cheap? How can we rebuild physically?
I think it's my temptation is to lean towards a fatalistic answer, which is we just have to allow this. Yeah, honestly, that's my natural tendency. That's my natural answer, because I've asked this question myself. My natural answer, if I'm being honest with you, is that we just have to let this play out. if we were to look at history, you know, once people get to this point of distrust, it would have to work its way out through the system, and people have to find out, unfortunately, the hard way, before there will be a turnaround. So, but that is completely fatalistic, and that's not really the best way to go about this. So what I would say is to, unfortunately, focus on, is it Gen Alpha? Those are the young guys, right?
Gen Alpha, Gen Beta, yeah, Alpha, yeah. 2019 or something. Yeah, Gen Alpha.
Yeah. So Gen Alpha and Gen Beta. Those are the two people I would focus on.
Is it too late for
us?
Gen Alpha is 2024, sorry. Yeah. Is it too late for the Millennial and Gen X?
Exactly. Honestly,
and the Gen Z.
You know, the truth of the matter is that people, as they get older, become set in their ways. Quite frankly, you know, in a world that is scarce of resources, I would say you focus all your strength on the generation that is coming rather than the generation that's current. I mean, people in millennial cohorts and in the cohorts of Gen Xers can still be persuaded to move over to the side of reason.
Yeah.
But you're gonna find out that it is a much harder job to do than to build a foundation. So, and I'm already seeing it. Honestly, I'm seeing it. And I think YouTube is gonna be critical to it. Mm. I am seeing a lot of content by people who are well seasoned scientist,
cool factors. Yeah,
the cool factor. They're making science cool again. They're making knowledge cool again. They're making critical thinking cool again. And genuinely, like with every human trend, there's always a counter trend. That's also helping as well. People are just tired of the mindless content, mm-hmm. and people are now beginning to look for genuine content. And I follow a lot of that. YouTube is such an underrated. I know people cite it when they're trying to argue facts, but there's a lot of good that's happening on YouTube as well.
Yeah,
I think
YouTube
should pay me a bit of money for this, but there's a lot of resources there. So I'm seeing, I wouldn't beat the science community too much. I'm seeing a lot of genuine effort from the science community to make science. I'll give you one of the best examples. Someone like Neil Tyson,
I love his thoughts.
I think the show is Star Talk. That's a show. I love what he's done with the show, right? So there's this comedian.
Star Talk.
So he's got a comedian to give a balance of entertainment, and then he's got himself, and then he brings on people. What I really love with it is he brings on people that actually say, wait a minute, that information you dropped on the other video is wrong. I'm an expert in that field, and this is what should be the correct information. He does that,
which in itself
is educating the people that are watching that there is, you should be okay with being wrong and being openly corrected, mm-hmm. no matter how knowledgeable you are. It's okay to be wrong. It's mm-hmm. okay to be wrong. And that in itself is what I like. Because if you listen to the one of the things that I notice with conspiracy theories is you just look for the one point of failure.
And then
they just hop on it and they say, if that's wrong, how can we trust everything that has come from that? So countering it with that, with being open and being said, look, I'm wrong. I'm wrong on this. But I'm right on most things. That intellectual humility, in my opinion, will help counter a lot of the distrust that people have for the science.
Yeah.
So to be honest with you, I wouldn't beat you guys too much. You guys are doing a fantastic job. And I just think, no, honestly, and I think that, and the reason why I love it is because YouTube is actually wildly popular with Gen Alpha.
Yes.
Especially Gen Alpha, because they're all trying to be like speed. I show speed. They all have their, and then they stumble on some of this fantastic content. I've seen my nieces do it. I've seen my nephews what they watch, and some of the content is fantastic. It's educational. So I'm hopeful for the future. Unfortunately, I think we'll have to give it a generation before all of this washes out. Yeah, it's unfortunate.
It's just not found here, right?
There's hope, but we have to give it at least one generation before all of this silliness goes away.
You're right. YouTube has honestly become one of those most powerful classrooms in the world. And yeah. I mean, Neil deGrasse Tyson, he's just been someone that I feel like he's always been relatable to me. You know, I love that he's willing to be challenged, and it doesn't come off as small even when he's wrong. You know, he's willing to say, okay, I was wrong about something like that. And I love what you said about intellectual humility. We all need to have that. Now, so there's so much good in how knowledge is being democratized online. Now, but even with all this progress, we still face a paradox, right? The same algorithm that promotes helpful science content also pushes conspiracy videos and quick fix truths as aggressively and sometimes even more. I mean, these days we're hearing about Romeo curing all kinds of ills. Now, these platforms reward speed, confidence, outrage. Curiosity takes time. It takes discipline. No one doesn't go viral. Yeah. So the challenge becomes, how do we protect and amplify the good without letting the noise drown out the signal? Because right now, everybody has a mic, but not everyone has a library. So my question here for you, Ogbana, is how do we bring nuance back into conversations that have been flattened by likes or takes and 30-second clips? How do we help truth become as compelling as the misinformation competing with it? Because it's hard on the streets out there.
Yeah, it is. I think one of the things is, which I have been against, is that those on like your community, people who are from your community should be much more willing to go out there and engage and have conversations with people who normally wouldn't have conversations with. I'll give you an example. We all know that Joe Rogan is the most popular
podcaster in the world, Spotify ranked.
He's the biggest podcaster in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, rather than, because you know, there's a huge subsection of people that absolutely hate his guts because they feel that he's helped amplify a lot of misinformation, mm-hmm. and he still does that till today.
Yep.
But and then I see those people berating anyone that goes on his show to say, why are you giving him a platform? My reaction to that is that, hello, he is the platform. He is the one giving you the platform. we have to recognize where we are. We have to recognize the fact that the truth of the matter is that the mad people have taken over the asylum. And we've lost. Mad people have taken over the asylum. And we have to engage. We have to adjust accordingly. How do we do it? Probably, you know, act like we're mad too, but obviously keep our sanity so that we can speak the language of the mad people without losing. It's a very, very, don't get me wrong, it's a very extremely difficult thing to do. Extremely difficult thing to do. Let me quickly give an example of what I'm saying. although this is not in the science space, it's more like in the cultural space. I'm very, very in tune with popular culture. So I watch podcasts like Joe Budden.
Oh, the comedian? Yeah.
Now, yeah, Joe. No, he's not a comedian. He's a former rapper that now has like a.
Oh, Joe Budden.
Joe Budden. Yeah, he has a podcast that is really one of the biggest in his space, in his niche.
The bald headed guy that looks like common. Pump it up.
That's right. He now has this guy that was on his show. I've literally just, his name just went blank. He's actually a professor. He's
Dr. Omar?
Not Dr. Omar. We have the internet for a reason. Give me 1 second.
Is it Mark Lamont? Mark Lamont Hill?
Yeah, Mark Lamont Hill. When Mark Lamont Hill, and the funny thing, I'm not completely a fan of Mark Lamont Hill, but he's an intellectual. That's the truth. He's an intellectual, and he's joined the show, right? And when he first joined, people were like, "What's he doing on that show?" Because you have
someone,
you have one of the other guests who's like a flat earther, right? Yeah, so you have, you know, that typical manosphere.
Red pill.
So at first, when he went on that show, people were like, what is he doing on this show? What is he doing there? But he's been able to elevate, he's patiently been able to elevate the quality of the conversations that happened on that show. So I'm afraid intellectuals are going to have to swallow the pill. I don't know that.
No point intended.
Right. No point intended.
What color of the pill?
Red, or both of them. Purple. Red and blue. Exactly. That's the one. Purple. They're going to have to, you know, just through gritted teeth, engage in these spaces. Because when you have one way information, those are the spaces that are influencing people. Even if it's not all the time, engage in these spaces every now and then and say, look, and bring a perspective that people haven't heard before. Not for the guest, but for the people who are listening. I think those are the ways. I don't think there's any other way. We have to engage. Let me not say we, because I'm not a scientist. But I think that people in good faith have to engage with anyone, some of these purveyors of misinformation, or what I call suboptimal information. Yeah. You know, I feel that there's a need to engage with this group, because we could do a little bit of good there. But again, going back to what I said earlier on, I just feel that most of the focus should be on the coming generation. Teach them how to think critically again. Teach them to engage with concepts like, you know, randomness, probability, how randomness is very important.
Yeah.
I think most people think that they understand what randomness means, but in reality, they don't. They don't understand how epidemics work. If they did, they wouldn't have some of the issues we're having.
Still having right now.
Because I think people I think our mindsets as human beings is we want to quickly put everything in a neat column. Mm-hmm. Neat in this is here and this fits into this box. So if you take it, you get this. If you take that, you get that. No, but it doesn't quite work that way. Our biologies are different. Our physiologies are different. People react to, you know, there are all sorts of genetic makeups that react to certain drugs in a way that is not good for them, even food, you know. So it's not just even about drugs and vaccines, even things like nutrition, right? It's like it's probably one of the most debated topics that you see on social media.
Yep. It's how to kill cancer. I'm like, calm down.
Exactly. Human beings love a one size fits all solution because it's neat. It's simple to understand. Unfortunately, real life doesn't work that way.
No, it
doesn't. It's messy. It's a bit scattergun. It's a bit, it doesn't work for this. It could work in this scenario. You know, people are not comfortable with saying, it depends. they don't like that answer. They like to hear a yes or a no.
You're right. Stepping into into public spaces isn't simple for scientists. We haven't really been trained. And I do science communication. It's part of my, what I do on the podcast and even when I work with my community advisory board. Like, how do we take what we are seeing in the lab and translating them at the grassroots level? But I think that 2025 has made that challenge even sharper, especially for the American folks, for the U.S. folks. For example, the U.S. federal science budget faced sharp cuts in this year alone. Research projects were canceled, grants were canceled, labs faced hiring freezes, and the funding and research agendas became tied to ideology. So I'm currently on a Fulbright, and I know that so many people who had applied last year were supposed to start a Fulbright this year if you did anything on climate change, inclusive science, marginalized communities. They use AI to sift out those applications and deny them, right?
Wow.
So scientists, we've not been trained to come out behind our peer reviews. We've not been trained to be in the spotlight. We're trained to publish, not to perform, right? And the shift from lab to live stream, you need a different skills like storytelling, relatability and vulnerability, which is not something we have. And many people resent that switch. Now, in this world, I feel like one of the biggest things as human beings is to be, going back to what you talked about earlier on about immigrating to the UK, how do we reinvent ourselves, right? Yeah. And so my challenge to scientists listening to this is that you need to find a way to communicate your research and the importance of it. And if we all did that on a collective level, because when the administration came for the institution, there was nobody left to defend us. Because when they were canceling other institutions, we just stood there in our high towers and just be like, okay, to the rules, you'll be great. Find something. But now, when they came for us, who was there to defend us? Because
no one.
The work we were doing, especially the ones that were being canceled, they were very exclusive to the community we were even passionate about. And don't get me wrong, those work had merit. Not all of them though, but most of the ones that are being cancelled, they had merits to them. But what does it mean? Like, why was this important? That was lost on so many communities, which is why the backlash wasn't quite as strong. We were still the ones trying to save ourselves, but it became very tone deaf. So that's what I'm just trying to say.
I think what you've just said now, just an idea just jumped at me.
What's that?
I think there are two, in terms of communicating, I think there are two approaches to it. The science field generally tends to attract people whose temperament is more melancholy and more laid back or introverted.
Mm-hmm.
So naturally, expecting those people to now communicate those things, it's actually a high
job. It's a job description.
It's an unreasonable expectation, to be honest. I'm just in the way you've just communicated it now actually brought home to me why some of the reasons why it's happened. So I mean, I think that the solution will be to actually create a and I'm sure that there is we have that already. But to do two things, approach it in two ways. A, make sure that communicating is not a major requirement, but communication is embedded in learning.
Yeah.
Learning how to communicate ideas is embedded in learning. And then B, actually create specific positions for people who can communicate, science communicators, and give them all the help that they need to communicate much more. Use the same internet that is being used, which is what's been done already, that is being used to spread this information, to also spread genuine information. So that's kind of like how I see it. So I think it would be that two-pronged approach where you try and encourage people in the science community to take communication very, very seriously. It is very hard.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at me talk. I struggle with communicating. I'm going to be honest with you, because many times when I speak with my friends and I'm talking about an idea or trying to relay something to someone, there's so many neurons firing in my head, and I'm like, oh, which how should I start? Communicating is probably one of the most difficult things to do.
Yeah.
So it's a completely different job. Making complex ideas very, very simple
to understand, yeah,
is a gift.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can get a mass, like a critical mass of scientists to be able to communicate at an okay level, what you now have is that you now have a critical mass of, you now have an increase in the number of top science communicators. As it is right now, we can literally count them on our fingers. What's that guy's name? The British,
who?
I think he's an astrophysicist as well. Brian.
The one that passed away? Hawkins?
No, not Hawkins. His first name is Brian. Brian Cox.
Brian Cox. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Brian Cox. He's a musician as well. He's a physicist and a musician. Brian Cox is an absolutely fantastic communicator. He makes, the way he communicates his the ideas about space and time and all of those things, it almost makes you feel that you're smart. So people like that, you know, we'll have more of them if we make communication. I want to shy away from making it a requirement in the science world, but almost make it such that incentivize scientists to learn how to communicate to an okay level. They don't all have to be Brian Coxes and the
level,
Neil deGrasse Tysons of this world. They should just be able to, you know, get out of their mind, their nerdy mind, and explain it in a way that people understand. And that's it, really.
Yeah.
I think that'd be a good solution, in my opinion. But not in the current climate where science budgets are being slashed in America, for example. But
yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah, hopefully we'll get out of this season soon.
That's a help. Yeah. Thanks for that insight. It really drives home how communication matters in all of this. It's not only just about how experts need to speak, but also how they need to connect. I remember when I was in grad school, my mentor, my advisor would tell me, if you cannot explain to your grandmother what you're doing, then you have failed at communicating your work, you know.
Sure.
When I was also in grad school, I took a summer class. It was a 4-unit class. It stressed people out. It stressed a lot of my colleagues out. And it was on science communication. But I go back and it's probably one of my favorite classes. Even before I left, you know, grad school, it was one of my favorite courses to take, because they train you in storytelling, in listening, and all of that. And I also like to share a resource to our listeners, especially for the sciences, the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Sciences. It's through the Stony Brook University, and they really help in being effective communicators when it comes to your sign. So if you're struggling with that, that could be a great resource, and I'll put that in the show note.
So, but I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
So this communication you took in your grad school,
yeah,
was it an elective? Was it taken as an elective, or was it like a?
It was required, but then I think after a while, because I don't think it's still being offered, but it was four credits, which was a lot, and it was in the summer. So let me explain what summer meant. Summer was actually like supposed to be like the lull, you know, point of your time in during the year. You don't take a lot of courses, you probably just work on your research. So for them to have made it required, but I loved it. But every week we were presenting, you would come present aspect of your research, like the introduction, and you had to almost like give a TED talk about it.
Right.
I should have seen it coming that I was going to host a podcast someday, because it was stressing though, my colleagues are, but I became like a theater kid. Like, you know, I would bring characters into my story. One time I had to go buy a doll and talk about, you know, nutrition deficiency. Like I was excited with the course, you know. And I remember at the end of it, I had gone on an internship shortly after then. I actually emailed the course professor to let him know, thanks to you, because I had to do a presentation at the end of my internship. Things I worked on. I was at a biotech company, and I infused elements from that course. And even one of the top directors stopped by and watched the interns, you know, present, and he made a comment about my presentation that's probably one of the best he's had as far as the interns, you know, presenting. And I had to email the course professor to let him know that, hey, you know, thanks to your course, you know, this helped me do blah, 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 blah. And I still go back to that course because it's really formed a lot of how I do storytelling. And taking it back to the grassroots, you know, like my lab, we're big on community engagement. We don't think science should occur in silos. Take it back to the community. Absolutely, so we do a lot of storytellings with, you know, the Black women we work with. We do town halls, we do podcasts in their own voices about the impact of cancer and how it's, you know, ravaging their community. You don't see that in journals, because journals, scientific journals, again, information's died there because we're just circulating amongst ourselves.
Yeah.
Heck, I pick some articles, even with my double degrees, I'm not even able to decipher what's being said there, because it's like, what are you guys speaking about? I can't even understand half of what is being written here. How much more the
sometimes
name?
Sometimes it feels like, I could be wrong, this is from me looking outside, it feels like with most professions, it feels like there's a need to be esoteric with the way
They reward that. There's a reward for that exclusivity.
I think those are the things that need to change. Mm-hmm. Those are the little things that need to change to make science, you know, available for everyone. Like you said at the beginning of this podcast, the printing. No, I think it was before we started recording. I think we're talking about the printing press, right?
Yeah.
And how that changed, how that made information accessible.
As something
that was formerly that wasn't accessible to people before now became accessible.
Mm-hmm.
What scientists need to understand is that accessibility leads to standardization. If you want to make a knowledge, and I'll give you an example, the printing press inadvertently led to the standardization of the German language, the modern German language we have today.
Mm.
Where, because of the fact that they now had to print the Bible, they could not print the Bible, you know, obviously. Mm-hmm. All of that whole Reformation, Protestantism and all of that, you know, the original, the Martin Luther Reformation led to the Bible being printed by the German press, and that now forced them to have to standardize the German language, because I think at that point there were like four different Germanic dialects that were all now standardized. So in an attempt to make the Bible accessible to more people, it now led to standardization.
But
and that's how you elevate the public, and that's how you have less mistrust. So I think that the science community should look into that. That I don't know. It might not be right for everything, but for every concept in the science world, but like I think it should be.
I think as we come to a close, I think that it's become more urgent when we look at where the world is heading, because now we're not just communication, that is, we're not just communicating with people online, we're communicating alongside machines, and everything we say, everything we do is being saved in this repository, which is being used to train these large language models. And AI is already shaping what information reaches us, what gets amplified, and even what we believe. So if humans, especially experts, struggle to show up in these digital spaces, what happens when algorithms speak louder than we do? I mean, take for instance, Facebook used to be one of the favorite places to go to kind of keep up with my friends and see what's going on in their lives. But I dread going there now because I go on my timeline. On my timeline, I don't recognize half of what's being pushed there. You know?
Yeah.
Now,
by some of our friends, by the way.
Not even just people that you grew up with. People you grew up with, like, what is going on with this person? What? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You're just wondering, okay, what happened?
Yeah. Now, let me ask you this as it comes to the close. As AI continues to influence how we learn, decide, and connect, what do you think the future of knowledge looks like? Do you feel hopeful, worried, or somewhere in between?
As long as we don't destroy ourselves, I think we're I'm hopeful.
What's the indicator for that? Like, how do we know that's the point with the steps for that? Yeah.
For being good, for being
hopeful. not destroying ourselves, like mature destruction.
I
what would be the signs? The blink for help. Blink twice for help.
I am afraid I don't completely have all the answers. I don't even know what that would look like. But I sense what is giving me a little bit of hope is the fact that human behavior is predictable, in the sense that what we're going through now humanity has gone through times of anti-intellectualism before in the past. It's happened before, right? We've had times where people have moved towards enlightenment, and we've had times where people have shrunk from enlightenment. Mm. We're just going through another of those phases. So what I mean by, because of the fact that between the last time we had this kind of massive withdrawal from enlightenment, we did not have the capabilities to destroy ourselves like we do now. That is what worries me.
Mm.
So if we can avoid that, because the thing is that information has now become a weapon.
Right? Yes, such a...
It has now become a weapon. So if we're able to, if cool heads are able to prevail and we are able to navigate this season that we're going through without killing ourselves, because we now have weapons to do that, then what happens is when we come out on the other side, we will have a situation where, unfortunately, I know many people, and some of them are my friends, will not like what I'm going to say next.
What is it? Say it.
We'll have proper regulation, because we will now be... Because the truth of the matter is that there are a lot of things happening, right? First of all, the AI innovation is being led by young people. And if you notice across board, you have an older and a much more octogenarian generation.
Yes.
In power, in political power. We have an older generation in power, and we have young people leading innovation. So we have to have people who are in good faith get into political power, who understand the terrain, and regulate in a way that doesn't stifle innovation, but creates safety, basically forces all these large language models. Because at the end of the day, some of the fears we have about all these large language models, right, are also the solution. So, for example, there's a fear of bias being built into large language models.
Yeah.
You can also build safety measures into the large language models. right? You can build controls, safety controls. You can
into
build
it, yeah.
You can build guardrails. You can build it into the large language model. So that's what I see. That's the hopeful part I see. Now, another thing I also see is that it actually, I think what AI is going to actually do when this hype phase is over is that it's actually going to increase efficiency for everybody across board. It's going to be like how we went from fax to the internet, how we went from slow mail to the internet. That's how I think it's going to impact. So, for example, from sending mails, we could now send emails, right?
Yep.
That had an impact on every. It wasn't just technology companies. Obviously, they were the innovators, but everyone could set up a website and everyone could now have an email rather than sending mails, right?
Yep.
So I feel that the impact of AI is going to be felt across. But if you look at what a lot of the leading people say about AI, all the times is the future that they are predicting is more of a future for the AI companies themselves. On how valuable they'll become. But I feel that the mistake they're making is that they're looking at these large language models as companies rather than as tools. I don't know why. I think it's because they were created as for profit. Unlike the way the internet started as non-profit, you know, the basis of the internet is that it was non-profit. You didn't have to pay. Obviously, you had to pay for the wonky stuff you built on top of it, but the internet as we know it is free. Does that make sense? The protocol level, it is free. But AI is starting where at the protocol level, it's not free. It is driven by profits. But my suspicion is that what these AI companies are going to find out very, very quickly is that they are building tools that really and truly should be open source, and gatekeeping it. They're going to find out very quickly that gatekeeping it and trying to make huge sorts of money out of it, like what OpenAI is trying to do, is not going to work. And we're already seeing little by little, we're seeing that happen with the rise of DeepSeek. It's kind of like has the hype cycle for DeepSeek has dipped now.
Yeah.
But so all I'm trying to say in essence is that the future I see is where efficiency, true efficiency, when this hype cycle dies, kicks in. And the real gains of AI will now kick in and you will feel it. I will feel it. Governments around the world will feel it because they'll be able to do things much better. I don't know what it will look like yet, but my suspicion is that what we currently have, this current iteration of AI is not it. We're going to, when the hype cycle dies and when there's a bust, because the hype cycle has to die, all the speculative cycle has to die, and when AI is no longer, when building an AI platform is no longer profitable, but just a provision of a tool or provision of a platform for people to build on, when it's no longer profitable at that level, then we will see the impact. Again, I know I've waffled a bit, but that's what I want to say. I'm hopeful. Yeah, I'm hopeful for a future where we'll all be much more, we'll live in a much more efficient world. But it's not going to be the current iteration of AI that we're still, in my opinion, far off. And also, I'm hopeful that's obviously based on the fact that we don't bomb ourselves back to the Stone Age.
Yeah. Thank you for all of that. I know we started this conversation talking about anti-intellectualism and the voice of dissidents, but I would also love them to be quite as vocal when it comes to the unethical use of AI, Because a lot of what I'm seeing with AI now, especially the ones that are being shoved up in our faces, they reflect the anxieties of their creators, right?
Yep.
Tell me why we need, for example, Meta glasses, where, was it, I forgot who, what her name is, one of these IG content creators. She, and maybe that's a reductive way of presenting her, but she's on Instagram. She talked about how she wore this for a whole day and she didn't see the need to talk to anybody. She wore the glasses. She says, tell me a story, read me a book, tell me more about this building I'm standing in front of, show me the way to that thing. Instances that will make you want to engage with other people and have a social field day. For a whole day, she didn't find a need to talk to anybody, you know. And I guess, you know, hope you, so when I asked you about the question about you being hopeful, you said yes, you're hopeful. And I think that hope is real as long as we don't self-sabotage, because it's risky. The warning signs and the breakthroughs, they often show up at the same time. Anyways,
I just wanted to add something to that quickly.
Yeah.
I genuinely feel, and I'm already beginning to see it, I genuinely feel that there's going to be a counter-cultural reaction to the automation of everything. To give you an example, for the first time in over a decade and a half, Gen Alpha.
I love how you always pause before I call the right Gen.
I think it's Gen Alpha or Gen Z. Gen Z's use of social media has not only peaked, but has started to reduce. And there is actually a demand for in-person entertainment by that particular generation more and more. And so people are going to get tired of all of this AI things. And that's what I'm saying, that it's just going to become a tool that people use in the end for efficiency.
The current
iteration that we have is just, it's going to get so good that it's going to become part of everything that we use, that we wouldn't know that we're using
kind of like cell phones
AI anymore.
Look at GSMs.
Exactly.
When it came, we used to call them GSMs. Now we don't even think too much about it. Like, I remember when I had to carry a calculator and a wristwatch, but I can do everything on my phone and I can still call and don't have to stand up and go to a night owl box and scratch a card and then make a phone call to someone that somebody picks up the phone on the other end of the line. Yeah.
Exactly. But guess what? Guess what? Since you got the phone, you still go on dates with your
significant other. I love doing that, because
thank you.
Exactly. I'm as a creative, I'm thinking now that anybody can write ups, anybody can do that. But immersive experiences, videos, and not just AI videos, but like showing your behind the scenes, what makes you human.
Machines
can't replicate that. This is why we need to flood the internet with more of those relatable stories and, you know, the struggles of being human. And let's not let the noise of AI and all of that drown out why we need one another, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. I'm confident that there's actually going to be demand. And the good thing is that, you know, the way capitalism works, I know people don't like it, but the way capitalism works is that where there's a demand, there'll be a supply. And that is how that counterculture would work.
Maybe to force us to come out more, you know, because we've been couch potatoes, like with AI flooding everywhere. All right. So I have to let you go, but I have some quick questions for you. When you look back at your journey, and these are quick responses, when you look back at your journey, what are you most proud of?
How do I answer this? I think I am most proud I'm proud of the fact that I've been able to take care of my mom. I don't know what answer to give you, to be honest. If I'm being honest with you, I don't I've not I've not really thought about it. Like, what am I proud of? I don't know. I think if I'm to give an answer, one of the things I'm proud of is the fact that I've always looked outside of traditional spaces that people are looking at, I was able to catch on trends like the Web3 space, example. I think that's one thing I'm proud of myself for, being able to look at. It was something that I learned in my, I learned over like, 10, 12 years ago. Yeah, so that's one thing that I'm proud of, being able to see around the corner and looking at spaces that people are not, and actually having proof of the fact that that trait works, you know, my relative success in that, in collecting and being engaged in that space. So I don't know, I don't have a neat story to tell you.
No, that's beautiful though. You being able to capitalize on that and then taking care of your mom, that's really warm and really nice to hear that. And congrats and kudos to you. Kudos to you on that.
Thank you so much.
Alright, two more questions. Second question is, what challenge would you leave to the next generation, the Gen Alphas and the Gen Betas, about thinking boldly and daring to question?
Can you say that again, please?
What challenge would you leave to the next generation about thinking boldly and daring to question? So like the Gen Alphas and the Gen Betas,
What challenge?
Mm-hmm.
Especially the Gen Alphas that are coming from, I don't know what to tell Gen Alphas from the first world, to be honest. I think they're pretty much, in my opinion, distilling. They're pretty much in an environment that doesn't hold them back. So I'll say, I'll direct my challenge to Gen Alpha from my third world countries and Nigeria. Nigeria ranks very high in power distance index, which essentially means that we like to defer to authority too much. That's just the simple explanation of that. So my challenge to Gen A and Gen Z is to challenge that, is to throw that toga off, is to challenge authority more, especially in our context, in the Nigerian context, in the third world context. It will serve them to do that. So that's my challenge. So challenge authority more, especially again in our context where most of the time people in authority have been, let's just say that they have not been optimal for our progress. So
I love that challenge. I think they are more, they are very up to the task. I believe in their generation a lot.
Honestly.
Yeah. What kind of intellectual legacy do you hope your work and ideas will leave behind after all is said and done?
I hope to leave a legacy where I caused people to think. I most importantly want to live a world where people lean, especially again, I'll go back to my Nigerian roots. I want to leave a legacy where people who look up to me learn or see the benefit of having enlightened interest, rather than just being about myself, my family, if we're safe and all of that, you know. So essentially enlightened self-interest rather than just living for yourself. That's how I put it. Again, it's in the Nigerian context. Nigerian context forces you to only think about survival, right?
Yes.
But being able to think about survival as a community, in my opinion, is the legacy I want to leave behind. I think it's a problem with Nigerians, especially, that we don't think about the other person. You know, as long as we're safe, we're good. You know, me and my family.
Me and my family.
Yeah.
But I think it's a reflection of the infliction we've been subjected to, right? If you think about the Maslow hierarchy of needs, how do we get to that self-actualization when we haven't met the basic needs, right? The same Nigerian, you take them out of that country and take them to developed countries with more better infrastructure, and they thrive and they become like, oh, how can we help other people?
Hear me. Even those of us, even the Nigerians that are outside, we still struggle as a collective. We're individually brilliant and we're individually ambitious and we're doing well. Don't get me wrong, we still come together because we're forced to. Even, but if you navigate those Nigerian spaces abroad, you'll find that those deep-seated distrust that we took away from Nigeria, that selfish gene is
human condition.
That's me saying we are defective. We're not defective. We've just basically learned from our environment how to navigate the world based on what our environment told us, which was look out for yourself, look out for people that are like you only, don't look out for the common. And you know, I think it's because of the way it's been communicated, self-interest, the way it's been communicated to Nigerians is that, oh, be the too goody shoes person. So yeah, I don't want to go into.
Yeah, no, I mean that could be like that could be like a whole podcast episode right there. But I just want to push back a little bit, but if you may, respectfully, I don't think it's unique to Nigerians only, right? I still think it's a human condition, and we've been thinking about it. Our economic and institutional legacy. The economy, Nigerian economy, the education, employment system, there's been a lot of instability, corruption, and underinvestment, which has affected how Nigerians prepare for global mobility. And then when we get abroad, there's that dual pressure to fit into our host society and also represent our home culture, right? And all these factors, you know, we're doing well, right? But we may still feel stuck in a collective sense. And that's pursuit of stability takes a while, and which is why I think we might come off as, you know, selfish. So no, I don't think Nigerians are unique in facing these struggles, but some aspects are more pronounced for Nigerians compared with other groups, right?
Don't get me wrong. They're, like you said, it's a completely different podcast. There are many factors why we are the way we are. There are very many factors, and I don't know if you've read Faye Farmi's book on the history of Nigeria from jihad to the amalgamation. I think that's one of the best books I've written on why we are where we are. I mean, that's what I got from the book, why Nigerians are the way we are. Mutually suspicious of each other. I'm not blaming Nigerians at all. I'm just saying that there's a legacy I want to leave behind. It's to pass the message across that says, look, this is not just being about goody-goody. It's actually strategic to move together as a community rather than...
And it's safer too.
It's safer.
Perhaps and that part will be self-actualization, not for ourselves, but also for our progenies and for posterity's sake. If we can start coming together collectively, there's that safety in numbers, right?
I think you're pushing back as well. And what occurred to me when you're pushing back is it will be easier for the next generation.
For sure. Because that's what we do it. That's what will make us transcend beyond every man for themselves, right? It's one of the reasons why I keep doing the podcast, you know, to leave something behind. So that way our voices and our processes are forever archived in the digital, hallowed space of, you know, digitizations of processes and all that. Yes. Anyways, this has been great. What a beautiful and honest conversation we've shared. We've shared a lot about your childhood memories in Nigeria, to finding your footing in a new country, and the courage it takes to open our mind wide open in a world that rewards noise over nuance. I love the lot of your feedback and tips, for especially for men who are moving across countries, and to remain open-minded and adaptive, and even find fun, for example, going to see a local match. And you also reminded us that curiosity is a kind of strength, that asking questions is how we stay alive, how we stay awake, and how we stay connected to meaning. And yeah, so as we head back into our everyday life, I'd like to challenge the listeners. I hope you carry one thing with you. Your mind is a gift. Your curiosity is welcome. And to the generation coming ahead, Gbane reminded you to challenge authorities, and your desire to understand the world is not too much. It's your superpower. And Gbane, thank you for bringing such a heart and humor into this space. And so our listeners, thank you for seeing the value in conversations like this. We hope you keep choosing growth over comfort. Until next time, this is Mom reminding you to stay curious, to stay kind, and never dim the light of your brilliance, okay? Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. This was great. I will let you know when the episode comes out, but okay. This was rich. I think I have to bring you back to talk more about the diaspora and push and pull. Let me gather enough material so that way to be a good use of your time. But this was really good.
Absolutely.
I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Anytime, please. Anytime.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hopefully my internet will be better.
Don't lie. They don't need to hear that part. Let's protect the Yankee people, because I didn't even have quirky internet. I used to have a co-host who lived in where was it again? Ipswich.
Yeah.
Horrible internet. It became a butt of a joke. Like, you know, what mood is your internet in today? You know, let's see. We couldn't even turn on the video. Yeah.
Trust me, I get this a lot. I don't know why. It's supposed to be fiber optic, but for some weird reason.
It's fiber for sure, but it's not optic. All right then. Take good care.
Thank you so much.
All right, bye.
All right, bye.